the ramparts and wetting the guillotine's blade, singing capitalism's in crisis. So where are the barricades? Why don't they close down the city and throw all the gamblers in jail? But they're still making money, make money, as they slice up the future for sale. And Sir Numbskull still hugging his bonus. Lord Grab has made off with the loot, and the slick city traders, the corporate raiders, freebooters and fraudsters, hedge fund speculators, the stock market scammers, brain dead regulators, why aren't they all getting the boot?
Have you ever wondered how a radio station works? Find out by joining KBOO's engineering committee. Or, do you have a radio, electrical, or audio engineering background and are looking for a good way to use those skills for good? Join KBOO's engineering committee. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The next engineering committee will meet Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out. Do you? Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Tumation needs a TTTTT. Thank you for your love, for your care.
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is now 9 o'clock. Up next is Radio Zine Presents, an interview with Cameron Denzin-Hammond. Susan LeGrand speaks with the writer about her new book, This Is My Body, a memoir of religious and romantic obsession. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for over $4,000 worth of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands.
KBOO is having our annual book and record sale Saturday, December 21st from 12 to 10 p.m. There's a special member-only preview hour from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. The sale will be located at Jupiter Next in the Arium Ballroom at 900 East Burnside Street. KBOO is currently accepting donations of used and good condition books, records, CDs, and cassette tapes. KBOO is hosting sorting parties for this event on Friday, December 6th and Friday, December 13th at 5 to 7 p.m. at KBOO's 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. If you're able to help with sorting or help on the day of the sale, please contact volunteer@kboo.org. We hope to see y'all there.
One of the great challenges in helping local folks who are homeless, they may be camping out, living in a car, sleeping on a friend's couch, or some other transient arrangement, is to make regular contact with them. In episode 3 of Local Folks Podcast, Helping the Homeless, Alita, the president of the Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center, talks about how they reach out to the homeless to provide needed services. You can find Local Folks at KBOO.FM. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO at the Clinton.
There's a program that I just went to speak at in Las Vegas of incarceration engagement there last week. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do. You know, they try to be the support group for families that have a loved one incarcerated. And so groups like that, there's definitely a need of people because, you know, people don't like to talk about it, but there's the victim's family, but the family of the person that committed the crime are victims as well.
Yeah.
You know, they have to go through a process of grieving. They have to go through a process
Right. It touches everyone.
Yes. You know, it touches everyone. Mm-hmm. And so they are also in need of support. You know, my parents, when I first got incarcerated, you know, they lost their home. You know, I put my parents in debt, you know.
They lost their home? Lawyer.
Yes, oh, wow. They lost their home because I committed my crime in that house. Uh-huh. You know, and they went in debt, you know, paying for my lawyer. You know, they faced many, many financial challenges. And, you know, had it not been for the church helped them out. But the emotional toll, you know, the whole situation, you know, someone. And then it's like their fear for me. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what was going on with me in prison. Okay, well, you know, what is it like? What does he have to go through? What is the process? You know, so to have people that can help, you know, families understand, okay, well, this is the process. This is what he's going through. He has to go through diagnostic. Then he's going to get his unit of assignment. Then once he gets to the unit, you know, you can go online and see the different type of educational programs and units have. Encourage your loved ones to get in this, to get in that, get in that. You need that. That mm-hmm. would be vitally important, you know, as far as, you know, helping the family to understand what their loved one is going through, but also having their loved one to be able to have that support from the family as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. I'd like to talk a little bit about race, because race matters.
Absolutely.
And here in KBOO, we have a principle of beloved community, and we really want to prioritize ideas that, like, elevate discussion around this and really try to minimize the role that white privilege plays in our system. White supremacy is like rampant in our culture, and it plays such an integral role in how incarceration is done, how prison is done in this country. As someone who's been incarcerated and has seen the effects of that growing up in Texas, you know, being sentenced at 12 years old to a crime that, like, a lot of white children would probably not have to serve, honestly. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, just honestly share with me your perspective on the role that racism has played in your life.
Well, I believe that the people that create the policy are not the people that come from the situations or the type of living circumstances that, you know, children live and go through. They commit the type of crimes that are affected by the policy that they create. And unfortunately, you know, the people that create the policies are not minorities. People that create the policies don't grow up, you know, in underprivileged households. You know, and so the reality is that, yes, you know, it is a distinct bias against, you know, minorities and people that are not of privilege. You know, and I believe it to be sad in the sense that if it was your child, you know, that had to deal with some of the issues, you know, that I've dealt with, you wouldn't want your child to have to go through what I went through, you know. But because it's not your child, because your child, you know, grows up in a different environment and is subjected to some of the traumatic experiences that I've been through, then, you know, that doesn't resonate with you as far as, you know, of you voting or trying to enact these policies that would keep children incarcerated. You know, and the sad fact is that, you know, mostly when I was at TYC, it was mostly minority children that were there, you know, that committed, you know, these type of violent crimes. You know, so whereas race does play does have an impact on policy, and it does have an impact on how long a person is incarcerated. And that's just the reality. You know, people, it's a hard topic to talk about. You know, but it's like, you know,
I know.
You know, the people
I appreciate
that,
it.
Yeah, but the people that create the policy, don't come from the same type of backgrounds that the people all affected by the policy come from, mm-hmm. you know, and that's just the reality.
And when you were doing time in prison, I've heard that like a lot, especially in Texas and in other states too, that oftentimes the general population kind of gets segregated.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And so I have a story to tell. I was a peer educator in the Gang Renunciation and Disassociation Program. It's a program in the Texas prison system that allows guys that were in administrative segregation for being confirmed gang members, or for guys that was in administrative segregation for violent acts against other inmates or officers, it allows them to get out of administrative segregation. And so when I first got to the Rams unit in 2008, I had a real good friend. He was a peer educator that was a part of this program, and he invited me to become a part of the program, right? And so I didn't know what to expect, because I'm like, okay, these guys are getting out of administrative segregation. You know, I just want to be there. You know, I had been locked up at that time almost 20 years. And so I just wanted to be a support system for them as they reintegrated back into population, because they've been in an isolation cell 23 hours out of the day, you know, for 10, 15, some of them 20 years.
Oh, my God, really?
Yes. And so, you know, and so it's like for them, you know, just like, you know, when we're released from prison, there's a reintegration process for us to get out of prison. Well, for the guys that's been in administrative segregation, there's a reintegration process for them to come back.
Right, just to get into general population.
Yeah, to general population. And so I became a part of the grad program. And so my very first class, the classes are phase two is when I had them, anger management, because I ended up becoming an anger management facilitator for some of the, you know, the most violent men in the state of Texas that was in segregation. And so it's a 16-man class. Mm-hmm. And so my very first class, 16 guys walk in, 8 of them were white, 8 of them were Hispanic. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's like, and the white guys got the swastikas and the lightning bolts. This is Aryan Brotherhood, Aryan uh-huh. Circle, White Knights. Uh-huh. You know, and then on the left side, you got the Mexican Mafia, Texas Syndicate. You know, and so it's like, I'm in this classroom and I'm the only black guy there, right? Uh-huh. You know, and so the nature of prison is that, you know, it's three different doors that you go through in prison. You got the white door, the brown door, and the black door. Uh-huh. And, you know, and you're going to naturally, you know, associate and assimilate with your own race. It's just natural what happens, mm-hmm. you know, and so, and it's sad, but, you know, it's just reality. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, me being there, you know, I got the white guys on one side, Hispanic guys on the other side, they looking at me crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, and so we had an open, and I used to have an open discussion, like every first class, like my very first class I did it, and then every class after that, mm-hmm. I used to ask them, you know, okay, well, how do you feel, you know, about me being here? It's, you know, open discussion, mm-hmm. you know, and so I used to get a whole bunch of, a nigger can't tell me anything, mm-hmm. you know, this toad, and then I found out he used to call us toads, you know, it's different disrespectful terms they used to use, mm-hmm. And so I used to get that initially, but then what I did, and that's the importance of communication, and that's what my programs for the kids is based on, communication. See, when you establish the right type of communication with people, you know, to let them know that, look, I'm not trying to be a big I and you're a little you. You know, we both on the same level. We both have, you know, different issues that we deal with, that, you know, we're going in the same direction. See, when you're authentic, color doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're coming from a real level, color doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, and so that's what I kind of got across to those guys, and I taught those guys, and they end up trusting me. And at the end of 3 months, you know, I got guys with lightning bolts and swastikas hugging me, calling me a brother. You know, that's you know, and that was a very powerful experience for me.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, we got over that barrier, you know, but it was because of, you know, good communication and, yeah. and them seeing that, look, I'm going through therapy just like y'all going through therapy. You know, we all in this, you know, this struggle together.
Wow.
You know, and so that was my experience of overcoming barriers of racism, uh-huh. but that was just a isolated, you know, event, because generally, you know, our population, you know, it's just, the reality is that, you know, everybody's going to see to their own race.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe being an ad seg for like 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
Like just, I just, that's so cruel though.
Yeah. Terrible. So, I mean, 23 hours out of the day, you know, you get 1 hour rent. You know,
did you ever have to do any time in ad seg?
No, I didn't.
Good for you.
The closest that I had to go to ad seg was when I was stabbed, and I had to
That was for your protection?
No, it was for while I was under investigation.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, while I was under investigation. But I was in that 6x9 for like 13 days. And I couldn't go anywhere. So when you're under investigation, you're stuck in a cell. But those guys, they lived the whole, and that's like a whole different world. I used to work back there. I was a janitor back there for like 2 years. They have a whole different world back there, you know.
I imagine.
Yeah, it's a whole different world.
I think it's so cruel. It's
absolutely,
it is. It's the prison within the prison.
Yes, it is. Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. So family plays a big role and support plays a big role. It sounds like education played a big role too.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that for the last part of this interview, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the role that education played in your success. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, I can. I guess, you know, the thing that's important about education is really not the things that you learn in class. Mm-hmm. It's the people that you meet. You know, and it's like when you are surrounded, you know, birds of a feather flock together. So when you are surrounded by people that's heading in a positive direction, you know, the people, you know, that have the courage to dream even while inside of prison, you know, because, you know, we're told about the things that we can't do. You got the X on your back. When you get out, you're going to be denied this. You're going to be rejected here, rejected there. But in that schoolhouse, you know, you got a whole bunch of guys in there that's just dreaming. When I get out, I'm starting my own business. When I'm going to get out, and, you know, I don't care anything about those obstacles. You know, I'm going to overcome, you know, whatever come my way. And that's generally the attitude of most people that are there, because you're paying your money to get this education, and you got a plan for what you're going to do with that education. Mm-hmm. You know, and so to me, it wasn't about the classes, you know, that I took, but it was the people that I met, because they also encouraged me and motivated me to dream. That, look, you know, I was incarcerated when I was 12 years old. You know, when I get out, don't place no limitations on the things that I can do. Mm-hmm. You know, and I also learned there in education about accountability, you know, to be accountable. I had a lot of professors that came in from the outside that was part of the colleges to teach us. Now, they always teach about accountability, you know, and you learn that unless you hold yourself accountable for the things you've done, you know, then you can't move past those things. You know, I have to be accountable for, you know, for my actions, and accountable for my future. You know, so my actions in the present, I learned in school that now my actions in the present are going to affect my future. You know, mm-hmm. with this education that I'm getting right now, you know, it's going to put me in a position, you know, to see once I get out. And so the greatest thing about getting an education in prison is about the, you know, the people that you're around, the people that you're going to learn from. You know, it's going to rub off on you. It's guaranteed, you know, and that's why, you know, research shows that people that are in prison, that receive higher levels of education are the least likely to recidivate. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's a very, very good environment. And if people do have loved ones that are incarcerated, I encourage you, you know, to tell your loved ones, you know, to get involved in school, regardless of, you know, of what their scores are or how they, you know, how hard they may feel like the work is. The greatest benefit that's going to come out of that are the people that they're going to meet while they're pursuing their education.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. So you've been out since January 2000.
Thank you.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is now 9:30. We had a little technical difficulties there, so we sadly missed out on our interview with Cameron Denzin Hammond. Now we have at 9:30, Radio Zine presents Burn It Down, Women Writing About Anger. Susan LeGrand interviews writer Lily Danziger about her recently published collections of essays.
Good morning, I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine. Today I'm speaking with Lily Danziger, writer and editor of Burn It Down, Women Writing About Anger. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I think the topic of this book, Women and Anger, is particularly relevant in this time that we are living in. And I just want to start with your introduction, because I think it really sums up so nicely where we are at with respect to anger. So you say in your introduction, throughout history, angry women have been called harpies, bitches, witches, and whores. They've been labeled hysterical, crazy, dangerous, delusional, bitter, jealous, irrational, emotional, dramatic, vindictive, petty, hormonal. They've been shunned, ignored, drugged, locked up, and killed. Kept in line with laws and threats and violence, and with insidious, far-reaching lies about the very nature of what it means to be a woman, that a woman should aspire to be a lady, and that ladies don't get angry. That's a lot of social conditioning against anger. I'm wondering if you could tell us why you think anger has been so denied and not allowed for women. Why is that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons, but the biggest one is that if you want to keep someone in a subjugated role, you know, if you want a group of people to be second-class citizens and to exist mostly to satisfy the needs and serve the purposes of, you know, the dominant figures in society, which for so long have been men, you know, it only works. You can only keep people in line like that if you can keep them docile. And women get angry when they're not willing to accept the lesser role that they're forced into. They get angry when they want to take up more space, or that a lot of women don't even realize they're angry.
That That's a high level of repression right there.
Yeah.
So in your book, you talk about some of the different kinds of anger that women experience and are writing about. It's a collection of essays about anger. Could you talk a little bit about some of the different kinds of anger that the writers express in Burn It Down?
Yeah, I mean, there are a ton of different forms of anger. You know, we have different ways of experiencing it, and also, you know, different parts of our lives that it comes from. So the writers in this book are coming from lots of different vantage points. You know, it was really important to me to make it a diverse and inclusive collection and to bring as many different perspectives in as possible. So a lot of the writers are talking about the way that anger intersects with their different identities, whether that's, you know, racial identity, religious background, sexuality, gender identity, disability, chronic illness, you know, all of those things bring their own backstory, their own context, their own form of anger. So that's one element of it. And then there's also just the different ways we experience anger, from, you know, big outbursts and loud stomping rage, you know, which might be the first thing you think of. But there's also the quiet, seething anger, and the anger that comes out as tears and that you might experience as sadness, and anger that manifests itself as guilt if you don't want to feel it as anger. And, you know, that was something that came up over and over again, is that when the writers in this collection were not in touch with their anger or not wanting to face it or not letting themselves feel it, it found other ways to come out. You know, it came out as different emotions.
I've often heard people say that depression is often a mask for anger, and we have epidemic levels of depression at the moment, particularly within women, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely often true, and that was something that came up in a few of the different essays. And also, you know, sadness is more socially acceptable in a woman than anger. You know, the sad girl is a trope that society is comfortable with. She's the damsel in distress, you know, the beautiful melancholy. It's not threatening the way that anger is.
Is there any way that women are allowed to express anger in a socially acceptable way? Is there any, I'm just wondering if all anger is not allowed or only certain kinds of anger?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are certain situations where anger is expected from women, but even when it's expected, it's still often belittled or downplayed or, you know, pushed aside or thought of as, you know, a woman just getting worked up. You know, I guess we expect a woman to be angry if she's jealous over a man, right? Or if, you know, fighting with a boyfriend. But even still, we usually look at the woman as angry rather than looking at what might be making her angry. You know, we look at the hysterical woman flipping out and yelling at somebody for no good reason rather than thinking, you know, maybe she does have a good reason. I think, you know, we also are starting to make more space, at least, you know, to expect women to get angry on behalf of their children. But again, you know, motherhood, as much as people want to talk about it being the most important job in the world and all of that, it still is so disrespected in a lot of ways as well, and thought of just as like, you know, oh, that's, she's just being hormonal, she's just fighting for her kids, but you still won't really look at the structural injustices that are behind her anger.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about it, I think that a lot of times women are allowed to get angry on other people's behalf, on the behalf mm-hmm. of their children or the planet or mm-hmm. kind of some larger issue, but not when they talk about themselves and their own situations. Mm. Do you think that's true?
That, I mean, that sounds true. You know, that makes sense to me. Yeah, we see women as endless sources of compassion and, you know, defenders of other people, people, you know, people who will fight for their children or their loved ones, or, you know, even will be involved in activism and fight for a cause. But yeah, I do think that's easier for a lot of people to stomach than a woman actually getting angry on her own behalf and drawing boundaries for her own well-being and, you know, standing up for what she will or will not accept personally. That still is just, like, incomprehensible to so many people because they're not used to expecting it. They expect the compliant, accommodating, gentle role from women and don't know how to deal with it when we step outside of that.
Mm-hmm. You talk a little bit about how women's anger can be a tool for social change. Could mm-hmm. you explain how that works?
I mean, you know, that's the anger at injustice that we're speaking about, you know, and I think that anger on behalf of a larger issue, anger on behalf of societal needs and, you know, in the face of injustice is just as important as anger for the self. You know, just because there's a little more room for it doesn't mean it's less important. And I do think that women are capable of huge change, you know, and have been at the forefront of so many activist movements throughout history and are at the forefront of activist movements and progressive movements today. And that's, you know, that's really important. But I also wanted to kind of slow down a little bit because I feel like the conversation about women's anger that's happening a lot these days is very much focused on that and how we can use it as a tool, how women can change the world with their anger. But we still haven't even really addressed the fact that in so many situations we're not allowed access to that anger in our own lives. And I feel like we need to make space for it in the personal and get comfortable recognizing when we're feeling anger and saying clearly and directly, I'm angry, before the responsibility falls on our shoulders of saving the planet with our anger.
Mm-hmm. You comment at the beginning of the book that millennia of conditioning is hard to unlearn. So given all of the ways in which women have been socially conditioned not to feel angry or recognize their anger, how is it that they unlearn that tamping down or suppressing anger? How is it that women learn to express the anger that they are feeling as anger?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an ongoing process. You know, we're not just going to flip a switch and all suddenly have a healthy relationship to our anger. You know, that's something we have to continue to teach ourselves and each other. But that's a big part of what I wanted this book to do, you know, and why I wanted it to include so many different perspectives and so many different kinds of stories, so that any woman reading this book can recognize herself and her anger, you know, and feel like she's invited in, you know, and given the permission to feel angry, to express anger, to burn it down together.
Mm-hmm. For the writers who contributed to this collection, was there any process they had to go through to access their anger, given, of course, that they're also subject to this kind of socialization that you've discussed?
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, I mean, I can't speak to what each individual writer went through in the drafting process, but I definitely know that, you know, in editing, that's a lot of what the process was. It was, you know, we were talking about the writing, but we were also talking about the anger itself and where it comes from and how to express it. And, you know, I asked a lot of questions like, you know, okay, but what does that feel like? What goes through your mind when you're feeling angry? Where do you feel it in your body and what does it feel like? You know, just kind of pushing them and helping them kind of find pathways to really put the anger on the page.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that, you know, the idea that it's okay for women to express anger if it is for a cause, if it is productive, mm-hmm. so to speak, is mm-hmm. allowed. But you talk about the idea that it doesn't have to be productive, that we should be allowed to express a full range of anger regardless of whether or not it can be made useful. Could you talk a little bit about that idea? Why should we be allowed to express a whole range of angers, not just productive anger?
Yeah, well, you know, a whole range of emotion, even. You know, I think that's what I said in the introduction, that if we're gonna have equal footing in society and we're going to be seen as respected as full, complex individuals with interiority, that means accepting that we have a full range of emotions and not just the pretty ones. You know, women feel more than love. We also feel anger. We also feel disgust. We also feel outrage and sadness. And, we feel everything that human beings feel. And I don't think we'll ever be given a fair shake in the world if it's still unacceptable or taboo for us to speak up when our boundaries are being crossed.
Mm-hmm. So then part of the oppression and also part of overcoming oppression is being able to claim the full range of emotions we actually feel, as opposed to those which are socially acceptable to others.
I think so, yes. You know, and you see that in the double bind. You know, it's even women of color are put in even narrower constraints than white women. You know, and the slightest bit of the slightest display of any kind of negative emotion from a woman of color will send sensitive white people running for the hills, you know, saying she's being mean, she's so angry, or she's so harsh. You know, it's just a way to discount what a person might actually be reacting to and what they might be angry about with good cause. You know, if you only react to, oh, she was mean to me, or oh, she's so angry, and you bring the focus onto that, that's a very convenient way to avoid talking about the thing that made her angry in the first place.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the double bind. Could you explain a little bit more what that is?
Yeah, well, when people talk about forms of oppression, you know, it's sometimes easier to wrap your head around one at a time. You know, we talk about sexism, we talk about racism, but the fact is that women of color, you know, they're not just dealing with sexism in one moment and racism in another moment separately. They're dealing with both at once. And those two directions that, you know, the oppression comes from, they come together into something even bigger and uglier than the sum of their parts. And, you know, I mean, I think all of the women of color in Burn It Down speak to this much more eloquently and with much greater authority than I can as a white woman, but I think it's something that it's really important to be aware of. You know, I'm a white woman here talking about how women should be allowed to express anger and talking about the places in society where there is a little bit more leeway for that, but I also try to always be aware when I'm talking about this that access isn't equal for everyone, and that, like with so many things throughout history, just because things are getting a little bit better for white women doesn't mean that they're getting better at the same rate for women of color. And that's something that we should all be speaking up about and rejecting and fighting for.
Mm-hmm. You envision your book as a place where women are allowed to express the full range of their anger. Are there other places that you see where women are allowed to express anger at present?
I mean, Alanis Morissette is about to do a tour with Garbage and Liz Phair. I feel like that's going to be a safe space for some women's anger. I'm going to try and get my pre-sale ticket. You know, I mean, yeah, I think there are a lot of spaces that are specifically or mostly for women, whether those are public or private spaces. We've all always been expressing our anger to each other in secret behind closed doors. And I think the issue now is getting it out into the open and finding a way where, you know, it's not just in special circumstances where it's allowed, but where we can speak up just as much and just as forcefully as any white man at any time.
Mm-hmm. It seems that expressing anger in interpersonal relationships is particularly difficult for women, given that much of our training is not only about being nice, but also not hurting anyone's feelings.
Right.
I'm wondering if you have in the essays or in your studies developed any ways in which women are creating spaces or any ideas about how women can create spaces in interpersonal relationships where it is you're dealing with somebody who you want to keep in your life, most likely.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is just getting comfortable saying what we actually mean and not just what we think the other person can stomach. But part of that responsibility also has to be shared. You know, that's on the men out there who are in relationships with women to basically sack up and deal with it and, you know, understand that if you're in a relationship with a woman, she's a human being and sometimes she's going to be angry and sometimes that anger is going to be justified and you should listen.
Mm-hmm. Listening is really interesting. We talk a lot about women being able to express their anger, but perhaps we also need to talk about men being able to hear women's anger. Is that part of the problem?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's only so much, like with any fight for equality, you know, the oppressed group can fight and scream as much as they want, but at a certain point, people who are in the position of privilege to hear or ignore those screams are going to have to step up and listen and be willing to open those doors and make that space. You know, I'm always grateful for men who are aware of the disadvantages that women face and the challenges we face all the time and try to help and, you know, make a little space. You know, male colleagues at work who tell you how much money they make so you can ask for a raise if you're being unfairly compensated, or, you know, male partners who are willing to listen and whose egos aren't too sensitive to hear the ways that, you know, their partners might be unhappy. Mm-hmm. Little things like that go a long way.
What price do we pay if we don't allow women to express their anger and we don't allow anger to be heard?
I mean, it's going to come out one way or another. And, you know, I don't think it's really, it's a matter of whether it comes out in a healthy, constructive way or not. But I think we're approaching the point of no return where, you know, enough women are understanding that what they're feeling is anger, that there's not going to be any turning back or shutting it down. It's just going to be whether it's a constructive conversation or not.
Is there anything that we have to gain by hearing and speaking truthfully about anger and what makes women angry?
I mean, we have everything to gain. Yeah, I mean, as women, we have autonomy and clarity and fulfillment and peace to gain. And as a society, we have, you know, equity and growth and progress and, you know, the ability to right wrongs that are causing the anger to begin with. And we have everything to gain.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, what motivated you to write this book about women's anger?
I actually didn't come up with the idea myself. It was developed, the idea of an anthology about women's anger was developed in-house at Seal Press, and they reached out to me to ask if I would be interested in editing it, and I jumped at the opportunity. It's a topic that I've thought a lot about and written a lot about and talked about with my friends, you know, ad nauseum. So I was really excited to put this together, you know, and to reach out to brilliant writers and see what they had to say and see what they could teach me and what we could make together, you know, and the idea, the focus of what exactly it was going to be really came together as the pieces started to come in. It was really shaped by what I was getting from the writers, you know, and the title Burn It Down came from, you know, I was thinking about, you know, what comes into my mind? What do I feel and think when I'm really, really angry? And to burn it down is the first phrase that came to me. We kind of kicked around a couple other title ideas, but we ended up coming back to that one just because it felt honest and real, you know, and that's an expression of how I feel and what I want to do sometimes when I'm really, really angry.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised by anything that you learned in the process of putting together this collection of essays? Is there anything that you didn't know or any insight that you had having collected this group of essays?
Yeah. I guess, you know, there wasn't anything that came totally out of left field and was completely unexpected. It was more of a crystallization of a lot of things that I might have vaguely understood to be true, you know, but then seeing it on the page, it became undeniable. You know, one of those was, like I mentioned before, how many other emotions anger can masquerade as when we're trying to push it down. You know, that ignoring it never actually makes it go away. It just will find other, more destructive ways to come out.
What would you want a reader to take away from reading Burn It Down?
You know, my biggest hope is that, you know, especially women who are reading Burn It Down will develop a deeper understanding of their own anger and will feel, you know, some permission granted, some access allowed to that anger, and will feel like, you know, a little space has been made for them to feel it and express it and to know that they're not alone and know that there's nothing wrong with them being angry, that they probably have plenty of very good reasons to be angry, and that a lot of us out there are angry too.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And anybody listening, if you want to check out Burn It Down, please buy from your local indie bookstores or IndieBound or directly from Seal Press.
I have been talking today to Lily Danziger, who is the editor of Burn It Down, Women Writing About Anger. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine on KBOO FM Portland, 90.7 FM. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Time is now 9:59. Up next is Flashpoints, but first this from KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of A Towering Task, the story of the Peace Corps on Sunday, December 15th from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. A Towering Task is a documentary film which talks to host country nationals, Peace Corps volunteer and staff, and scholars and journalists about peace building, economic development, and political independence through the Peace Corps' nearly six decades of trials and transformation. Again, that's A Towering Task, the story of the Peace Corps, on Sunday, December 15th from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Flashpoints.